Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. A looming general election, a party on the verge of an historic landslide, a leader with an iron-like grip on message discipline, waging war on complacency. Sound familiar?
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
Education, education, and education. Tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime.
A politics of courage and honesty and trust.
Welcome to Lessons in a Landslide, an exclusive Red Box podcast series to mark 20 years since New Labour swept to power. In previous episodes, I've spoken to the Labour's big beasts about life on the campaign. In this episode, I speak to those on the other side of the fence, the journalists from the Times of the time who reported on the battle buses, the spin doctors, the chickens, the bulldogs and the gay lions they found on the campaign trail. I'm delighted to be joined by Philip Webster, formerly of Red Box, plus Jill Sherman and James Landau. Welcome to you all. Okay, so let's start then. Where were you? What was your job and what were you doing in the run-up to the 97 election? Let's start with you, Phil.
I was political editor of the Times. I'd been political editor for 4 years by then. But the previous near two decades, my job had been to lead on covering the Labour Party. So I had watched them through four periods of opposition, and this was the moment they finally escaped.
You'd put in the hard yards. Labour
Party in those days was based in Walworth Road, and I'd spent many days of my life in total standing outside Walworth Road waiting for the latest national executive disaster to happen. And they were happening all the time, right until, you know, the sort of the period after 92, when the Tories started digging a very big hole for themselves.
And Jill, what was your job then?
I was chief political correspondent at the Times. I'd been in the lobby for about 4 or 5 years before that, and was also doing the Labour beat. So I was very much deputy to Mr. Webster, which was great fun. So I went out and about, obviously. I didn't go on the bus for the election, but I was in the office then, doing a lot of the kind of policy briefs and stuff like that, which I'm interested in. But I was, tasked to do Labour, I think, as soon as I went down to the lobby. That was my beat. Yeah.
And James, you were on the battle bus.
Yeah, I was the cab reporter. I was the young lad who Phil sent out to all the dog work. So I went to all the boring press conferences and filed lots of copy, and not much of it ever made the paper.
I used to get of it.
He used to take in a few parts. It meant that I physically had to go to all the ridiculous stunts that we had to do. The favourite thing I always remember, actually this was before the campaign, there was a big thing. One of the big slogans the Labour Party had was 22 Tory tax rises that they said had taken place under the previous regime. And I remember going to Millbank Tower, the Labour Party headquarters, where they had a stunt of the day arranged by Peter Mandelson. And the stunt was they'd got a test your strength machine, right? One of those things with a hammer that you hit and then the thing goes up to test your strength. And of course, the measure were the 22 Tory tax rises. And the sort of the gimmick was they'd got Britain's tallest man, some complete giant, to come on and do it. And so we watched solemnly as this man, and he was so big, he was very ungainly and could hardly hit anything, as he did all this for the cameras. And this was the era when the big gaffe was for a political party to use an actor or a civilian for part of their promotion, but then we discovered they voted for the other side. So, of course, inevitably, we wanted to ask this poor giant, you know, how did he vote? The Labour Party had cottoned on to this. And so we all immediately went up and said, look, how do you vote? Like that. But they tried to whisk him away. The trouble is getting rid of a bloke who's kind of sort of 8 foot plus, absolutely, staggering around. And so he whisked off. We all charged after him. There's a bit of a scrum. And then I've never seen Peter Mandelson so angry. He was screaming and shouting at the entire pack. He accused me of being a member of the Federation of Conservative Students as a result of me. And he then put in a formal complaint to the Times. Fully remember this.
I do.
That I have to say, the people who actually put in the complaint were slightly embarrassed by having to do it. Said that I had somehow shoulder-barged a member of staff, which was totally untrue. But that was the madness of the era.
Yeah, talking about stunts that didn't quite come off, the Tory party at the time was in total disarray, and they got this lion that they campaigned with a lion. They used it as a symbol, the symbol of the lion, and they used this picture of a lion in all kinds of broadcasts and things. And one of our colleagues, who's not here today but who was with us, discovered that the lion was gay. Do you remember that?
The other animal was the Labour Party got a bulldog called Buster, who was there to, which they used for some of their promotional material, which was designed to sort of show how patriotic they were. Because, of course, sort of foreign affairs was always seen as one of Labour's weak points, and they wanted to try and sort of tickle that up. So Peter Mandelson arranged for this dog to be photographed. But it subsequently turned out that the nether regions of this dog had been airbrushed out for fear of offending the voters.
Yeah. Yes.
Which caused a bit of fun.
But it was a very serious election.
It does sound like we don't get. Why is it we don't get stunts like that anymore?
Because they
go wrong.
They so often went wrong.
We've
had people turning up with chickens at press conferences, haven't we? To try and portray the people holding the press conference as chickens, and that always went wrong. It always rebounded. But on the election itself, the thing that, looking back on it now, and covering for all that period, was the amazing caution that Labour showed in the run-up. What people forget is that both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had been in Parliament for 14 years. They both came in 83. They'd had 14 years of opposition. Neither of them were suited for opposition. They were both just interested in government. They'd had all this time to wait. And although everyone in the press, everyone in the public knew that Labour was heading towards a certain victory, the people who seemed least convinced of that was Labour themselves. So we had this amazing caution over policy. The great business on within 12 hours, Labour had leaked to me on a Sunday that they were going to stick to 2 years of Tory spending policies. Which the Times ran as a splash on the Monday morning. Gordon Brown went on to the Today programme the next morning to talk about the Times splash and announced on the Today programme that also they would not, for the next Parliament, be putting up the basic rate or top rate of tax. So we had that in 12 hours, utter caution, utter unnecessary caution. Ken Clark, who had been the Tory Chancellor, has since said many times that he wouldn't have even stuck to his own spending policies had they won the election in 97. So there was Labour hamstrung for 2 years on Tory spending policies that the Chancellor of that time would not even have stuck with himself.
George, do you think that's because they were so scarred by that long period of opposition? They felt they had to address every perceived weakness of the Labour Party, despite the conditions meeting they would have probably won it even if they hadn't made those promises?
Yes, I think so. And I think that they were also trying to play to several galleries at the same time. So they wanted to play to the wider public by trying to appear more Tory than the Tories. And they were also trying to play to their own party. And I think they always found that difficult, always in the run-up for the, sort of the year before, the year after. They were continually flying kites for this policy, that policy, and then somebody would bat it down. Gordon Brown would want something on, you know, benefit spending. Blair would bat it down. And it was always because they were playing to two audiences, and I think that was always a problem for them.
And it was about this time that they stopped telling each other what they were about to announce as well. So that you, the tension... That one reason, I think, for the tension between the two, and it went on to be the TBGBs, and it lasted virtually until Blair went in 2007, was the fact that they had waited for so long. I think that had a big part in it. And, of course, the factor that we haven't mentioned was both Brown and Blair, after 92, were deeply impatient. They didn't think that John Smith, who was Labour leader at the time, was pushing reform fast enough. I remember a dinner with Blair. It was myself and Peter Riddle and Blair at Brighton in 93. He gave us the distinct impression that he wouldn't be hanging about for long unless Smith got on with the reform. And, of course, sadly, John Smith died the following year and Blair was left to get on with it himself. But that was very much a factor as well.
I had a Peter Mandelson complaint about that. Even though we're not allowed to talk about lobby lunches, do you think we can from that era?
Of course we can.
I think yeah, it's long enough ago now.
Of course.
What's he going to do now?
So I had lunch with Peter Mandelson. He told me fairly and squarely that he thought John Smith should be, this was before, obviously, John Smith died, should be doing much more on the doorstep about spelling out what Labour was going to do about modernising the party, etc. And then there were two articles, I think, in the New Statesman, one of which was, I can't remember who one was, and Peter was the other. And he told me basically what he was going to write in the article. Then I put that in the paper, including some of the quotes from the article, with the spin that, you know, they wanted to push John Smith to do more. God, hell broke out. And Mandelson complained to Peter Riddle, Phil Webster and the editor of the Times, and said the whole thing was rubbish. Were we going to publish a letter in the Times? I think Peter Stoddard said no. Phil said I should talk to Peter Mandelson on the phone and not exactly apologise, but find out what he had to say. As soon as I phoned up Peter, he sort of said, oh, no problem, no problem.
Yeah. So it actually seemed to be...
Typical.
Seemed to be cross-dressed. Yeah, yeah. So as we've sort of got onto it, what the sort of the outside impression of the new Labour media machine is this sort of rigidly driven, obsessive, controlling... Was it like that to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, yes. One myth, though, is that spin began in 94 when Blair took over. I mean, we had Tory press officers. Bernard Ingham was a master of spin in many ways, the man who accused John Biffen of being a semi-detached member of the cabinet in a lobby meeting and got away with it at the time. So it didn't start then. But yes, Mandelson was the man with the message. Mandelson was the man with the red rose. Mandelson was the man who came up with New Labour, New Life for Britain, and that became the mantra. And then when Alistair Campbell took over running Blair's machine in 94, that's when the discipline came in, trying to make sure that they all came out with the same message. And on getting into government in 97... I think that's right. He set up what was called the Strategic Communications Unit, and the whole idea was that across the ministries, people were supposed to be saying the same thing. Yeah. But he forgot to tell the Treasury, they did their own thing very much, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Well, just to sort of give you a sense of how it operated as a machine. Obviously, this was a different age technologically, and most of the material came in over faxes. There were no, you know, there was no internet. The Labour Party would have a very efficient network of people around the party who would scour the local papers, find an example of a Tory candidate saying something daft. That would be sent in to Milbank Tower. Then Milbank Tower would build a database of that, and then just selectively and slowly but surely leak these out, not all in one go, very carefully. And so I would have somebody from Bourbon say, James, I'm going to fax you something over, it's rather good. And then you'd have a row. Now, in those days, the rows happened much more slowly. These days, it pops up on Twitter, and it's over in a matter of minutes in terms of the counterfactuals and the rebuttal of the rebuttal and all that. In those days, it took a longer period of time. So a lot of those stories, would fill a lot of the space during the campaign that otherwise was filled with a fairly anodyne policy debate, because there wasn't a policy debate during the campaign. So it ended up being filled with quite a lot of sort of, candidates saying duff. But the Labour machine was far better at it than the Tory machine was.
And that's now become the template for, certainly what journalists see as a good machine. You know, at the moment, there's a big... there seems to be a feeling that the Lib Dem press office is doing actually a terrifically good job at doing that stuff. The FOI requests and the have you seen what so and so's done? You know, and it's.
I mean, the Tories were pretty sloppy just in the period before, weren't they? Before New Labour, at each other's throats the whole time. They didn't mind which journalists they told, what the journalists said pretty well. And so I think, Alistair was very, very keen to stop all that.
And we would get calls saying, how are you guys looking for Sunday? Do you need a Sunday for Monday? We've got a little bit of, some parliamentary questions we've got. We could say this showing X or Y, sort of unknown people like Steve Byers and Alan Milburn. That would be the vehicles for that sort of activity.
Alistair, as a former journalist, knew that if you didn't fill the gap, we would somehow. And I think the orders that he sent out to the special advisors and the press people was. Give them stuff. Give them stories. Create stories. And it became quite wearing. I mean, there was a time when even on a rare Sunday off, I might have played a round of golf in the morning, but I might then spend about 4 hours sitting in my car in the golf club car park, having received a phone call from Alistair Campbell or someone like him, following up on a story that they were proposing to run the next day. And you were talking about how it became the template. I mean, it was the template, really, for the Tories when they finally got back in 2010. And you've seen all over the place how Osborne and Cameron regarded Blair and the team around him as pretty masterful at this kind of stuff. And it has carried on since then.
They introduced the grid, didn't they, the Downing Street grid? I think that was Alistair, which has been kept going ever since.
One thing that hasn't sort of travelled well in time is that in those days the sort of monoglot single answer to whatever question a journalist would ask. In those days, it was almost acceptable to sort of do that. It was seen as sort of solid, good discipline, control. These days, I think the audience is more sophisticated and used to, and sees through it and says, "Sorry, hang on, you've got to answer the question." In those days, you could ask them, what colour the sky is, and they'd still tell you that they're tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime.
Yes. And it's that thing about the sound. Everybody knows what a soundbite is now.
Yeah.
The public do, the voters do, they completely get, I see what you're doing there, you're not answering the question, or you're...
The soundbite was most associated with Alistair Campbell, I think. Yeah. I think people, whether he invented it or not, people will credit him with the... or blame him for the invention of the soundbite.
And, of course, in the election, this was the election that invented Battle Bus Bingo, when we got all... what we'd do is we'd get... we'd write down all of Tony Blair's stock phrases. So tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, New Labour, New Britain, the many, not the few, etc., etc. Write them on a piece of paper, put them in a hat, and every morning we'd put a quid in the hat, all the journalists on the bus, and then you'd pick out three pieces of paper. You'd have your three pieces. And then at all the many events and speeches and chats and discussions had... Basically, you'd tick them off every time Tony Blair said it. And then when he said your third one and you were the winner, the only way you had to win was you had to stand up, even if it was in the middle of a press conference or a speech or anything, and shout, "House." and then after a bit, occasionally allowed to actually have some communication with the candidate, we would go. Tony Blair once asked me. He said, "James, I saw you stand up in the middle of my speech. I didn't. What was going on? Were you trying to ask me a question?" I said, "No, we were just playing Battle Pass Bingo." And I've never seen anybody look so sort of distraught, disappointed, depressed. Because just picking up on Phil's point, he was petrified with nerves. That he was carrying this Ming vase almost across the line.
And
we were sitting down so bored because he was not giving us any stories. I mean, he said the same thing five times a day. And he couldn't believe that we were being so trivial at a time for him.
You weren't taking it as seriously as he was.
Perhaps not.
So on the last... just to emphasise that again, on the last night before Labour were elected, so on the Wednesday night, polling day was on Thursday, May the 1st, 1997... I'm writing up the splash in the Times office, and the phone goes, my phone, and it's Alistair Campbell, and he's calling from Sedgefield. He's calling from Tony Blair's constituency home, where Blair had gone to be there to vote the next morning. And he'd rung to see what our Morrie poll was saying, which we were splashing on the Thursday morning. And this still goes on, and it happened then. So without giving him the figures, I just said, look, you know as well as I do, you're heading for a landslide. And I heard some sort of grumpy noise from beside him. And Alistair said to me, can you talk to him? And he puts Blair on. And Tony Blair comes on the phone to me and says, Phil, what's all this about you writing we're going to get a landslide? I said, well, you know you're going to get a landslide. Our poll suggests you're going to get a landslide, and I bet every other poll in the land is suggesting that. But if you put that in the paper tomorrow, nobody's going to come and vote, are they? And this was Blair on the night before. That showed the nerves. And I said, look, come on, don't be silly. It's not going to change anything at all. And papers are going to run their polls in the morning. And he was very, very grumpy. Even at that point, he couldn't bring himself to accept. And Alistair grabbed the phone back off him and said, oh, I'm sorry about that, but you know what he's like.
Can you remember how the poll compared to what actually happened?
Yeah, I mean, amazingly, if I told him what the poll actually would have said, he would have gone ballistic, because the poll pointed to a victory for Labour of 180 seats, 180 wow. seat majority, and it wasn't too far off. Labour, just to bring things back to the present day, Labour that day ended up with 418 seats. If today's Labour Party end up with half of that, they'll feel themselves pretty lucky. And that's the difference between 97 and now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It does seem like a long... I mean, it does seem like a particularly long time ago for the Labour Party. Just what we want, Alistair Campbell and the relationship between him and the press. Looking back through his memoirs, Phil, you crop up either he's very pleased that a story that he's given you has landed well, or you've gone and ruined everything because you've written something which has thrown the grid up into the air. What was that dynamic like?
I had a good relationship with him. I suppose the thing that helped me in my job was that I had, I would say, equally good relations with the Blair camp and the Brown camp. And it's for my colleagues to back me on that, but yeah. I did. And I never would ever go to the other side and say, they're being nasty about you. They're saying you're flawed or whatever, this, that, or the other. You would have to deal with them separately. And both sides knew that. So if I was getting a story from the Brown camp, I wouldn't immediately go running to the Blair camp and say, I've just got this from Gordon, you know, and the other way around. And I think they knew that I treated them almost as separate entities.
Separate
it was very weird, which was why, as you say, Alistair might be quite happy if one of those golf club Sunday morning stories had come off. He'd be equally unhappy to see me running a story, one of Brown's team, say Charlie Whelan, might have just slipped to me the previous night. That a story of which he knew nothing.
Do you think at any point the relationship between the media and the new Labour opposition got operation, became too close?
It was certainly perceived as such by other parts of the political media. And I think it was felt because of the relationship that Blair had with News International at that time, that we were always treated with a certain amount of... suspicion, jealousy, envy by other parts of the political media. But I think as a political journalist, you have to get it as close as you can. You've got to get the stories.
You've got to get the stories.
You've got to get the stories. And how you get them, you know, nobody's going to have an inquest how you got them the next day.
I just wanted to add, I always thought Phil tried to get me to do all the bad stories about Labour. I always got the difficult ones.
It's a good story here for you, Jill.
Yes.
Well, you did them very well, Jo. I mean,
you assumed
somebody had to take the rap.
Jill, despite the nervousness about complacency within the Labour camp, given that you'd covered the Labour Party for a long time, at what point did you think they're quite obviously going to win the next election?
Probably is. As soon as Tony Blair took over.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was the sort of sealed the deal.
I think so, because, I mean, Major was doing pretty badly anyway. And I think, you know, it's Kinnock was pretty unlucky, really, not to get in 1992. And I think as soon as Blair took over in 1994, the whole mood changed, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, really.
I think we felt that Smith would have won, but he was applying the one last heave approach. And that was what Peter Mandelson, Brown, Blair didn't like. They didn't like the idea. They felt you've got to go full-throated for reform. But, yeah, I agree. I think Blair would have won, Brown would have won, and Smith would have won. But Blair was the one who was always going to appeal more to Middle England. And that was the reason they were able to get seats in the South. And it was pretty obvious in 1994 that he should be the candidate, despite the battle he had with Brown at the time.
James, I wanted to ask you, there's a terrific Twitter account called New Dawn 1997, which is, I think it's been run by some students, but it's sort of chronicling newspaper coverage of the campaigns that unfold. And your name keeps cropping up. So, you know, the reason I thought of it was one of the stories that you'd written was about this huge influx of women that was coming into the Parliament, which was a real novelty. It was a, you know, now you wouldn't get as much space being given over to papers, but that was a big deal at the time.
And it was particularly because actually when the result happened, and because Labour won more than expected, an awful lot of paper candidates for Labour who happened to be women got into Parliament. And so there was this huge new influx. You know, in a way that I think these days would not be acceptable. But in those days, they were then referred to as Blair's babes, particularly because there was an iconic photograph of Tony Blair surrounded by them all. And what was really interesting is that some of them went on to flourish. Others fell by the wayside actually quite quickly because they just found the whole process of politics just sort of completely not prepared for it.
If you'd stood as a candidate sort of out of politeness, not expecting to win, and you'd just been swept along with this sort of tidal wave.
It's one of the great sort of things that people always forget about that, because there were so many new Labour MPs, and a lot of them were kind of councillors who'd sort of been told, look, can you just put your name forward? And they suddenly came in and they got quite quickly quite fed up with just being little more than lobby fodder, because a lot of them, particularly if they're lawyers or you know, councillors who had executive jobs where they actually took decisions, and now they just did what they were told by Peter Mandelson, and they found it, a lot of them, I think, very, very hard that initial period. But there was we did a lot of work about how the sort of social structure of Parliament was going to change. I mean, the other side of the coin was Phil got me over the summer afterwards, after the election, to ring round every single Tory MP who'd lost his seat, and I became a sort of a roving agony uncle to a lot of these very, very depressed men who kept on asking me, you know, how can I get a job? And they got some pretty strange jobs, and I have to say one or two of them ended up in pretty sad ways, because for them it was just they'd lost, you know, their entire sort of way of life. It wasn't just a job, because they'd been in power for so long. And so you had this sort of counterpoint with the sort of the new Labour sort of uncertainty and the utter depression of the MPs who'd lost their seats.
Jill, one of the other aspects was there were so many of them, the prospect of promotion or doing anything more interesting than just being lobby fodder were minimal if you were a new MP.
I was going to say, as a lobby correspondent, I was one of a handful of women then, and there were probably about three of us. So it was quite a difficult place to operate. It was very chauvinistic. And although I think people maybe expected us to flirt with the MPs, obviously I wasn't going to do that. I was a very sort of feminist type, you know, journalist. And I remember Phil saying to me, it'd be quite good if you could talk to them about football or golf before you kind of go into your, you know, questions. And I was thinking, tennis, maybe?
So did your job become different or easier?
It's just modus operandi coming out to this.
So he didn't do any bad stories about Labour. He got you to phone all of the press tories, and then you had to speak to everyone about golf. When there was this big change in the makeup of the party, did that change? Because you weren't just speaking to sort of dusty old Tory men.
I still felt it was a very chauvinistic. Yeah. I think all the women in that era, the 1997 women, had to adapt to that, and they didn't like it. but they had to adapt it. It took ages for the hours to change, for the whole sort of flexibility of working to change. I mean, it took another...
It was Robin Cook becoming leader of the House that really modernised.
There were endless debates about whether or not the House of Commons shooting range downstairs was going to be turned into a creche. And I remember going down there with some Labour MP, female Labour MPs like that, and they went down there and they realised just how smelly and damp and horrible the whole place was. The idea that this would be a suitable place for children was not appropriate.
And the question, in fact, there is now a creche in Parliament. It's only opened in the last sort of 3 or 4 years. It's sort of that took that long. I know... If you go on a sort of unofficial tour around Parliament, I've had this so many times, people take you around Parliament, and they always point out the machine on the wall which dispenses tights, which was installed in 1997 because...
Is it really?
Because that's what the ladies want, obviously. It's a machine to dispense tights. Before we finish up, I suppose we should draw... we should look at where we are now 20 years later in the Labour Party. And, you know, there are people who say, is it completely finished? Or, you know... It's been in bad ways before. Can it come back? What do you think, Phil?
Well, it's in a worse state than it has ever been. Neil Kinnock's great gift to the Labour Party was to make it electable again, but he couldn't get in 92. But he spent the whole of from 83 to 92 trying to hold off the forces that are now in control of the Labour Party machine. And we all know that they were handed the keys to the door. They didn't even have to fight for it in 2015. And until the membership of the Labour Party changes, I don't see any hope of Labour returning to power, because the membership of the Labour Party, which has gone up 70% since 2015... So it tells you the kind of membership. It's a membership that came in to support Jeremy Corbyn, who was not relevant for most of the 40 years that I was involved. He was totally irrelevant, really, politician. And he happens now to be running our main opposition party. And with the membership as it is, even if Jeremy were to go in the next 18 months, which I think is quite possible, the chances of today's Labour Party picking a Labour leader who would be in tune with the British public, I think, is pretty low. So, as of now, Labour need its membership to fall.
It's got
a long way to fall before you get back to the level of membership and the kind of membership that would go for an election winner.
James, did you see a lot of Jeremy Corbyn on your battle bus tours in 97, presumably? Were you even aware of him existing as a political force?
Yes, because the only reason he ever sort of entered my consciousness was when he did things with Sinn Féin. Because that became a sort of, you know, and he was... he was part of a, you know... bit of the Labour Party occasionally you'd have to kind of, you know, engage with, but not that often, because it was so not mainstream in those days. I mean, just going back to Phil's original point that we began with, Tony Blair was in Parliament from 83 to 97 before Labour returned to power. You know, these things do change and the wheel does turn, but it does take a long time. And I think, you know, for Labour, they're facing a long time, you know, before the wheel, you know, may turn.
So, finally, before we finish, how many times do you all think you've heard things can only get better during that campaign? Was it played at every
thousands of times,
to?
Yes.
Oh, it was I won't test you by saying if you know all the words.
I have heard it. I've sung it myself. I have hummed it. I have murmured it in my bath. I've sung it with Heather Small in a bar. On some Labour tour when she was doing it, and then I've sat in the back of the bus with Dee Ream when they actually came with the ones like that.
Right.
I fear I didn't know him as such in those days. But you know, would that I should? I would have, you know, sort of engaged more closely. I feel I've heard the song enough.
So we're not going to play it again now.
It is still played at Labour Party.
Is it? But it's now a
events.
Sort of sign of defiance, isn't it? They sort of put it on when Jeremy comes into discos.
Yeah. No, it's it's still out there.
The thing that we forget from that whole campaign, that whole era, was that actually there was a huge amount of passion involved in it. Even from the electorate's point of view, where almost regardless of where people were politically, there was a sense that the country wanted a change,
yeah,
just because they'd had the same lot for a long time. And I can remember just the sense of, yeah, we joke now about the phrase time for a change and, you know, are you the change candidate, etc., all these elections. But in those days, that it was a genuine sense that's one of the reasons why so many voters voted, was they just wanted change. And I can remember random strangers coming up and sort of hugging me. Because they were so excited about this thing. And I don't think we've had anybody win an election since with that scale of hope. Because now it tends to be the least worst of the candidates.
On balance, you're marginally better than the other.
Whereas in those days, there was a genuine sense of hope. And I say that in a purely non-partisan sense, just of... You know, they'd had, you know, all the allegations about Tory sleaze.
Yeah, they'd had
economic, you know, they'd had the economic problems. They'd had the sense of just a sort of, you know, and it was, a government that was fighting amongst itself. Again, separate from any of the politics, there was just that sense. And I don't think anything since then has mirrored it.
No, it's hard to overestimate the extent to which the Tories had become a laughing stock in those last few years. Quite apart from the economic disaster that over the ERM, some bright spark had the great idea of trying to revive the Tories with a campaign called Back to Basics. at which point, you know, ministers, conservative ministers, senior backbenchers all started getting into all kinds of financial and other sexual trouble, and there were all kinds of stories, weren't there? There was a story a week, people getting up to all kinds of strange things. And there was one MP who had to admit to sleeping with another bloke on a rugby tour, and that became quite a big story. He was an MP, and that became quite a big story at the time. That was almost par for the course. We just waited for the next Sunday paper to see what was going to happen next.
There was a Labour machine ready to exploit every single one to the nth degree.
One of our colleagues on the Times in those days had a key on his computer keyboard. It's called a save-get key on the old system, in which you could save a few stock phrases or a sentence. Like, and on one of his save-gets, he had an intro that began, "John Major last night suffered a fresh blow after... dot, dot, dot." And he would just press that and away he'd go.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I think we'll leave it there. Joe Blandale, Philip Webster, Jill Sherman, thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Red Boxes series, Lessons in a Landslide. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss future episodes using iTunes on your Android device, and sign up to my morning Red Box email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.